University of Colorado.
Four, three, two, one, zero. Ignition. Liftoff.
Since the late 1940s, the University of Colorado Boulder has sent important experiments and instruments to every planet in our solar system. In more than 50 space missions, NASA spacecraft would launch hundreds of instruments from CU Boulder, as well as 20 CU scientists, faculty, alumni who've been astronauts. CU Boulder receives more NASA funding than any public university in the country. And CU Boulder's astrophysical and planetary sciences professor, Jack Burns, continues to have longstanding ties with NASA that benefit the university as a leading edge institution in space. Welcome, Professor Burns.
Well, thank you, Ken. It's good to be with you.
We had a couple of notable events recently regarding space that I would like to hear your view on. One was the launch of the SpaceX rocket from U.S. soil with astronauts aboard here recently. And the other was the announcement that Colorado would be the temporary home for 6 years of the U.S. Space Command. So tell us first about the significance of the SpaceX launch.
Well, the SpaceX launch really is it's paradigm breaking in many ways, because up till this point, all of the major launches, all of the both large and small launches, really have been done by government-led space agencies in the U.S., the European Space Agency, India, and so forth. So now we're in an era of these new so-called public-private partnerships, in which, starting a few years ago, individual companies have been launching resupply missions to the International Space Stations. These are uncrewed, but they provide supplies. So SpaceX and several others are doing that. Now, for the first time this last weekend, we had astronauts being launched by a private company. And what NASA was doing is, unlike in the old days, where NASA was controlling the launch, they bought the rocket, they were in charge of it. In this case, NASA is buying services, and the service is to launch NASA astronauts to space. So the company is in charge of building the spacecraft, of testing it, of making sure it's safe, of indemnifying the company for this, and delivering these astronauts safely to the International Space Station. So where NASA is going with all of this is that these are the kinds of things now that a private company can do. 50 years ago, it took the resources of the greatest country, the richest country in the world, the United States, to just be able to do these launches. Now private companies can do it. And so that frees up NASA to do the really hard things in space, to set up bases on the moon or eventually go to Mars.
So you see this as really the future of launching people into space?
Very much so. When I was on the presidential transition team a few years ago for NASA, this was very much part of our conversation and our recommendations to the then incoming administration, that these public-private partnerships represent the future of space.
University of Colorado was part of a consortium that worked pretty hard to get the U.S. Space Command headquartered in Colorado Springs. And of course, 6 years is still a temporary, but what's the significance of that announcement?
Well, there too, it just further solidifies that Colorado is really the center of space in so many ways, not just for space science, like what we do at Boulder, but also for space defense. The Space Command being here means that much of the advanced technologies, development of new satellites, new software, using things like artificial intelligence are being developed right here in Colorado. It really just makes it clear that Colorado really is the leading state. It certainly is in terms of looking at the per capita funding coming into Colorado for space. We're number one by a large amount, and we're number two relative to California in total, despite the fact that California has almost 10 times the population of Colorado. So that's pretty amazing.
So what will the U.S. Space Command do?
Well, you know, that's I was interviewed on this subject about a week or so ago. You know, that Netflix was producing this new Space Force TV series. So they were asking me what is similar, what is different from what's portrayed. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about the Space Force. It is not Captain Kirk going off to fight the Klingons or Luke Skywalker, you know, going against the dark side of the Force, but rather, really, what is being done is to secure the nation from external threats. And that mainly means new classes of satellites that do a better job of potentially detecting when, say, a hypersonic missile is launched and to be able to then defend against it. New classes of satellites that protect themselves from, you know, possible threats. So it's less right now about sending military personnel into space and more about securing that high ground, if you will, through satellite technology and much of the advanced software that's available for detection of threats.
You talked about the robust space ecosystem in Colorado, and certainly CU Boulder has been a big part of that for decades, really. How did CU get to be such a powerhouse in terms of aerospace?
Yeah, that's really an interesting question because CU was a leader in space science in particular, even before NASA was created, going back to the 1950s, that it was recognized that there was a potential for the high technology, as you said, the ecosystem to begin to develop here. There's some people interested in space. They moved to Boulder because it's a very nice place to be, even though there wasn't a lot of space work going on at that time. Then you had several graduate students in what was then the physics department. They had developed some early rockets to look at the sun, to look at X-rays and ultraviolet light that you can't see from the Earth. And they were responsible for starting one of the new aerospace companies that became Ball Aerospace. So it's one of CU's first spinoffs. So it's the kind of thing that it just grew, how do we say these days, organically. A few people started working in this area. It was identified that those folks were here. The infrastructure was beginning. We started winning some grants from NASA, Department of Defense, and it just continued to grow outward. And then you had also early on Lockheed Martin in the 50s and early 60s. They were testing some of the early Atlas missiles. They were actually testing those missiles in Colorado. So you had the early space defense also grew up within Colorado. So it's what kind of thing that snowballed over time. And it gets, you know, as we were more successful, that brought in additional funding, it brought in additional people, it brought in additional students. So, for example, in my department, Astrophysical and Planetary Sciences, we now have the largest undergraduate major in the country in astronomy and astrophysics. We have over 300 students majoring in astronomy and astrophysics. The next largest program is less than half of that size. Wow. And we began the undergraduate major only about 15 years ago. It's just another sign of how things just have blossomed and continue to blossom with time.
And you're the director and principal investigator for the NASA-funded Network for Exploration and Space Science. Tell us what that project involves.
Yeah, this is it's really a team of individuals, both at CU and we have 10 other university and lab partners that work with us. It's funded by the NASA Solar System Exploration Research Virtual Institute. It's a mouthful. It's headquartered at the NASA Ames Research Center in California. And it was a competitive program in which there was a call for groups of researchers to get together and propose some science-focused research that would advance our progress, particularly with respect to the moon, asteroids, and even the moons of Mars. So we're the only team that actually does astrophysics, and we also do heliophysics, the study of the sun. All the other teams are more interested in geology, lunar geology, resource utilization, and so forth.
So last July marked the half century anniversary of the first moon landing and Neil Armstrong's giant leap for mankind. At that time, you were leading a team that was asking what it would take to go back to the moon. Was that SpaceX launch a step in that direction, or have there been other steps in that direction?
It is. It is. All of these things are a step in that direction because, as we were saying earlier, with these public-private partnerships, that SpaceX has the technology to get to low Earth orbit. I've been working with a company called Blue Origin in Seattle. It's a company run by Jeff Bezos from Amazon. They are developing, in fact, the concept for a human lander. They're collaborating with Lockheed Martin, and they were recently selected by NASA to do a detailed design study of this so that they potentially could be ready to land astronauts back on the moon by 2024 as part of NASA's Artemis program. So the first woman and the next man to land on the moon. So you've got these companies, these private companies. Bezos is putting $1 billion a year, he's cashing in $1 billion of Amazon stock each year to put into this company. So what it does is we are no longer just dependent upon the public sector, but the private sector, Blue Origin, SpaceX, and a number of other companies as well, are investing. This changes the landscape. This allows things like this to happen, in which, once again, the same kind of partnership we just saw with the Dragon capsule launch this last weekend, NASA is also going to buy services on these landers. So these will be privately built, privately operated, and NASA will pay to land its astronauts on the surface. Because again, the perception is, unlike 50 years ago, this is no longer that hard. Yes, it is hard, but it's not that hard that individual companies can now have the wherewithal, both financially and the technologies there to be able to do it.
As someone who was born the same year Sputnik was, and having watched space travel as I was growing up, it seems to me like the notion of space is, for normal people, lay people, is as much about the imagination as it is about the science. You think that's so?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. A week or so ago, when I was being interviewed about the SpaceX launch, we were going on that, you know, space is cool. It's cool again, although I would argue it's been cool all the time. But when I was growing up, in the 50s and 60s, and following carefully the Mercury, Gemini, and then Apollo programs, it was, you know, this was the first time that we were leaving the surface of the Earth and leaving the Earth orbit and going off into space. Now, this space is much more accessible than it was 50 years ago, again, with private companies that are capable of landing both unmanned payloads as well as human landers on the surface. Then in the decades to come, many more people will be going into space. You know, Bezos has ideas for this human landing system as the first of being able to put thousands of folks living on the moon in 20 to 30 years. And of course, Elon Musk with SpaceX, he wants to do something similar on Mars, which is certainly going to be further off in the future. And getting a human to Mars is probably more like the middle of the century.
When do you think humans might revisit the moon?
A few years. The president's goal, this has been declared, is 2024. So that's just a few years off. It's going to be a real scramble to get there for that deadline. But whether or not we actually get there in 2024 or 2025, it's just the whole idea that we're working now for getting to the moon. I like to call this forward to the moon, not going back to the moon. In fact, we're doing a planetarium show with that title, Forward to the Moon, that is funded by NASA, because it's a whole new moon as far as we're concerned. Rather than going to the same places that Apollo landed, we're going to go to places like the far side of the moon to put down low radio frequency telescopes that my students and I are working on. We're going to go to the poles of the moon where there's water. You can mine that water, convert it into rocket fuel, and not have to bring all of that fuel from the Earth. As you can imagine, that's quite a cost savings. So we've realized that the moon, you know, 50 years later is a different kind of place. It's much more resource rich, has much more scientific potential than we might have thought a few years ago. And very importantly, it's only 3 days away. So it's accessible.
I know throughout your career, you've been a fierce and consistent advocate for space travel, space science. Talk to us a little about how that has been received. I mean, I think with the recent launch, the attention has gotten high again, but I think you've been out there some of the times when it's not been as high. What's been that process for you as being a space evangelist, if you will?
Yeah, it's been a long road for sure. I think the first conference I went to and proposed the first radio telescope on the moon was 1984. And there was beginning to have some talk about returning to the moon at that point. And that fizzled out in the George H.W. Bush administration. Then interest grew again in the early 2000s with George W. Bush administration and returning to the moon. And unfortunately, that fizzled out with the Obama administration. So I hope third time's the charm, in which now what's different, even from what was proposed 10, 15 years ago, is again this public-private partnership. You know, I've been told when I go and talk to my colleagues at Blue Origin, they tell me that Bezos is committed to go to the moon, whether or not NASA goes. That's in their long-term strategy. Bezos has this plan, a 100-year plan, if you can believe that, for development of space and space travel and exploration. That's unheard of for a company to be talking about that kind of timetable. But given that, all things are possible, and in particular, developing a sustainable presence in space, and particularly on the moon, I see is quite possible now. So I'm optimistic. I have to be, because I want to see this happen in the next few years while I'm still active and working in this area. But things have changed. You know, 35 years ago when I was starting to talk about this, people were saying, oh, it's just so hard to get to the moon, so expensive. And they were right. Today, that's simply not true. It's not nearly as expensive. I mean, we can get humans to the moon. During Apollo, it cost about $250 billion in today's dollars for the Apollo program. Today, we're talking about an increase in NASA's budget that's probably total over 5 years of about $10 billion. Okay. So, and that's because the technology has come along, that you have also the investments from the private sector to make this happen. You know, this is not an impossible dream any longer. This is going to be a reality in just a few years.
I'd imagine there were some years there where you felt like a voice in the space wilderness, but it must be gratifying to see all of the resurgent excitement about space.
It is, and I wasn't the lone voice. There were many others of my colleagues who have been talking about this as long or even longer than myself. I've been, you know, probably the leading advocate for radio telescopes on the moon for a long time, but that has developed a serious constituency and a lot of people now starting to work on this. We have two NASA-funded programs now that will place in a few years a satellite in orbit of the moon to do radio astronomy when the satellite is above the radio quiet far side. And then the second step later in this decade is an array of radio telescopes on the surface. NASA has funded both of those projects for initial concept studies, and we're moving forward to it. So, I mean, real things are happening, and in just a couple years, we'll be doing what we like to call, we're cutting metal, so that we're actually building satellites to make this happen.
And I saw that you and your colleague, Fran Bagenal, were recognized among the inaugural class of fellows for the American Astronomical Society. That's quite an honor.
Well, yes, we both Fran and I have talked about it, and we are indeed honored to be in that first class. I've provided a lot of service to the American Astronomical Society over the years. I served about a decade as a chair of the Committee on Astronomy and Public Policy. So I spent a lot of time advocating for astronomy on Capitol Hill, taking advantage of some of the expertise that I had developed, in fact, as vice president at CU. And then also serving as senior vice president of the American Astronomical Society just in the last few years. So I appreciate that recognition of that service, as well as the research that we've done. And my students and my postdoctoral fellows, of course, play a huge role.
You mentioned many things being talked about in terms of space nowadays, and one of them is privatized space travel. Is that something you'd like to do?
Well, I don't know. You know, I've not had a great desire to be an astronaut, like unlike some of my students, and who are continuing to apply and do that. And I wish them well. I'd like to have them on the moon and putting down my radio telescopes. But, you know, if offered a free ride to the moon, I certainly wouldn't turn it down. That's for sure.
And I think one of the things about space, too, is that it allows us to look literally beyond the horizon out to the future. So I'll ask you what you see out there in the future. You've talked about some of the things in the near term, but what do you see like a decade out or a few decades out?
Yeah, well, this word I was using a few minutes ago, sustainable, a sustainable presence in space. We haven't had that because after Apollo ended, we stopped leaving Earth orbit, and it's been 50 years now. So sustainability means that the moon is a first step in that exploration of space. That's going to be followed by going to asteroids, human and robotic missions to asteroids, then to Mars, and then further out into the solar system, going to the moons of Jupiter, that moon like Europa, which we know has an ocean of water underneath it and may be a place that houses life. Very different than Mars. And we progress outward. You know, in 100 years from now, I think we will be, maybe even before that, we'll be sending probes to other star systems as we continue to increase the efficiency of our propulsion systems. We'll be able to go faster and faster. I don't see us getting Star Trek's warp drive anytime soon. I would love it. I'd jump on board and want to travel to some of these other star systems, but just keeping within the Newton's framework of physics, being able to go, 90% of the speed of light puts a number of stars within view and within reach of unmanned satellites within a century. So I see that progression. But again, what we're doing right now is the cornerstone of a sustainable space program, to go and to stay, not to make this a flash in the pan, not to put flags and footsteps down either on the moon or Mars, but to stay, to work it, to live off the land, and to learn about both the challenges and the opportunities of living and working in space.
Well, Dr. Jack Burns, it's great to have someone with not just the expertise, but the passion for his subject. And we wish you all the best in what's ahead for you, and Godspeed.
Thank you, Ken. I appreciate that very much and look forward to traveling outward, at least through our satellites and our spacecraft to explore the cosmos.
The University of Colorado comprises four campuses, Boulder, Colorado Springs, Denver, and the CU Anschutz Medical Campus in Aurora. To learn more about CU, go to www.cu.edu. Thanks to our producer, Kathy Buten, and audio engineer, John Arnold. I'm Ken McConnellog, and we'll see you on the air next month.
University of Colorado.